Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Leslie Davis, and I am the attorney for the plaintiff appellant, Liddell Henderson, in this matter. What's here before you today is the question of whether or not the district court abused its discretion in failing to appoint counsel at the pleading stage, the fact stage, and the expert discovery phase of Mr. Henderson's litigation. Mr. Henderson's case being a deliberate indifference case, alleging deliberate indifference to his medical condition, resulting in end-stage renal failure. In Pruitt, the court analyzed and looked at two prongs that the court should look at to determine whether counsel should be appointed. The first is whether or not the litigant sought pro bono counsel on his own. Here, that's not in dispute. The district court said, yes, he had done that. It's really the second prong of the test that's before you here today, and that's whether the complexity of the case required the appointment of counsel and whether the literacy, communication skills, and the experience of the litigant required the appointment of counsel. Here, in this case, is a deliberate indifference case. And the court has been very clear that in cases such as this, where the defendant's state of mind is going to be at issue, as well as the need for medical testimony, that is highly unlikely that a lay person would be able to prosecute this kind of case on their own. Here, under these particular facts and circumstances, Mr. Henderson was completely illiterate. He could not read or write. He only had a fifth-grade education, was gravely ill, and only had the understanding of processes and procedures that to a childlike manner.
And so you were appointed, and there was no motion to reopen discovery?
I was appointed at the motion for summary judgment stage, at the response stage. And no, there was not a motion to reopen discovery at that point.
Why
by
not?
Myself. But Mr. Henderson had effectively asked for discovery to be reopened. He asked that the district court allow him additional discovery, and he was denied. He was denied that at the point where the court already knew of his deficiencies and knew that he had not had the opportunity to have any fact discovery, depositions, and his own deposition had been taken twice, wherein he could not even read the documents. And so at that point, so that's one thing.
Right, but the thing is, now that counsel was there,
yes.
The court didn't say you could not file a motion to reopen, right? You had that option.
No, the court did not say that, and that option was available. But at the time that I was appointed, the decision had to be made as to whether or not counsel, myself, thought that there was at least sufficient facts in dispute in which to go forward and respond to the motion. There was, at the very least, some medical records in the record, and there was evidence, albeit sketchy, at his own deposition about the timing and whether or not anybody had given him any knowledge as to his end-stage renal failure or any of those things. And so at that point, it was two reasons. One, he had effectively been denied the opportunity to reopen discovery. And two, I guess more importantly, every step of the way, the district court found somehow that Mr. Henderson was able and competent to litigate this case on his own.
Well, I guess the problem I have with Mr. Henderson's position is that the reason for the summary judgment was not some mistake that he made in the way he answered a question or failing to submit an interrogatory or something of that nature, but instead it was the failure to produce evidence that the treatment he did receive, which is in the record, the medical records you refer, was below, sufficiently below this acceptable standard that it would have constituted deliberate indifference. And it seems to me that's the kind of thing that if there was an absence of that information prior to the response to the summary judgment, a request to reopen it, discovery so that the plaintiff could produce some expertise or an affidavit or point to a treatise about the treatment for these problems or something of that nature, that could be done. So So I'm having difficulty finding that it was an abuse of discretion not to appoint counsel until the response for the summary judgment was due.
Well, the truth of the matter is that it was a judgment call, and that, yes, maybe some of those, maybe a motion to open rediscovery could have happened.
Yeah, that's a weak position where our standard of review is abuse of discretion.
What I want to draw to the court's attention is the case of Santiago versus Walls, wherein a similar thing happened where when counsel was appointed, counsel did not seek to reopen discovery at that point either, citing the fact that there was no reason for counsel to believe that there would have been a different outcome, considering the fact that considering the fact that the court all along had found that the plaintiff was competent to litigate his own case. And even in that case, the court found that it was not a bar to showing prejudice that counsel didn't seek to reopen discovery, that as long as it could be shown that there was, in fact, a prejudice, where, in this case, there was, considering the fact that Mr. Henderson was not able to take depositions or to defend his own deposition or read any medical records, that should not be a bar to showing prejudice in this case either.
So, but in retrospect, a motion to reopen would have been a better decision.
Agreed.
Okay.
If I can continue, we talked about the abuse of discretion and the district court's failure to put forth any analysis as to how the court came to the opinion that Mr. Henderson was able to competently prosecute his own case, considering all the deficiencies that the court was aware of, at least by the second time he had asked for appointment of counsel. There was the abuse of discretion there, because there was no citing by the court as to how they came to that opinion. We assert that no reasonable, rational analysis could have come to the opinion that Mr. Henderson was able to prosecute his own case, when in fact he was not able to do any of it on his own. He was being helped by an inmate who only also had a GED.
Since you're in your rebuttal time, if you want to save some time.
I will
but
save.
It's up to you.
I will save the rest of my time
right.
For rebuttal.
Mr. Is that Cherish?
Cherish,
all right.
May it please the court. I'm Michael Cherish, and I represent Dr. Ghosh, Dr. Aguinaldo, and Dr. Zhang. It's our position that the district court did not abuse its discretion in denying plaintiffs' first two motions for appointment of counsel, and there was no resulting prejudice from those decisions, which would require a reversal of the order of summary judgment.
The fact that the inmate only had a fifth grade education and could not read and was assisted by a jailhouse lawyer who had a GED, you think that was sufficient?
I don't think that it meets
and
the...
And that the court didn't need to focus on his capabilities, particularly in this case, when he had over a three-year period gone to the doctors, complained about his condition 10 times, and nothing essentially had been done?
I think that on both of the first two instances, the court looked at what was available to it in terms of making that analysis and properly applied the rules under Pruitt.
So what was properly available that would suggest that appointing counsel in an early stage under these circumstances was not warranted?
With regard to the first motion, which was in October of 2010, the court had before it three documents: an original complaint, a motion for appointment of counsel, and a motion to proceed in forma pauperis. By that time, I believe, if not shortly thereafter, the plaintiff had also effectively served all but one of seven individual defendants. When the court examined each one of those documents, each was well written, clearly articulated, neatly typed, set out all the elements that were necessary for a deliberate indifference case. These were well-written documents, well-pled documents, which exhibited a high acumen in terms of being able to proceed. Then the court, at that instance, applied the correct standard under Pruitt, i.e., is the complaint or is the complainant in this case competent to litigate a case of this type? The court specifically did consider his literacy, his communication skills, his litigation
and
experience.
So was his pro se counsel able to attend depositions?
I'm sorry, Mr. Doby? No,
yes.
He was not.
Yeah, so it was the pro se counsel clearly who put together the complaint and the paperwork.
You would assume to be that. I would assume that to
right.
be the case.
Well, yeah, because in taking depositions, you knew that Mr. Henderson was illiterate. He couldn't even read the deposition to sign it.
That's true. However,
so he couldn't be writing those
if
documents.
Mr. Dolby or even a lawyer had been there, his ability to object, as we all know under the federal rules, is extremely limited.
So you're saying that, well, so let's just take this in regular civil litigation, so then we don't even need a lawyer representing a witness in regular civil litigation because the likelihood of objecting during a deposition is slim?
No.
So it would have made no difference whatsoever?
No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that the lawyer or a surrogate's responsibility or his role at that point would be more toward legal matters and legal objections.
Exactly. Which, of course, the inmate, the jailhouse lawyer, was not there to make such objections.
That's true. But
because there are objections that can be made in the deposition in terms of foundation. I mean, there are objections that can be made that need to be made at the deposition so you can preserve it at trial.
Some of them, yes. But Mr. Henderson was sworn to tell the truth. He would have told the truth regardless of the presence of an attorney or a surrogate. It's the same situation.
That doesn't have anything to do with the oath. And that the oath is an entirely different situation than a lawyer being there and counseling during the deposition. Obviously, the lawyer can't talk during the deposition, but the lawyer can make objections, can make sure the process is followed. I mean,
that is true. And the absence of an attorney in a pro se case is a hurdle, unquestionably.
Did you learn anything in the depositions of the plaintiff that led to summary judgment?
I don't believe so. I think that it was simply a case that this man has a kidney condition. My clients treated that as physicians. There was absolutely.
He had no evidence to balance off the evidence that was presented by the defense that the treatment was suitable.
That's correct. In other words, we have physicians who provide a certain course of treatment for a kidney or a renal failure condition. Deliberate indifference, as we know, requires them to show not only that they deviated from the applicable standard of care, but that there was a higher culpability. And the district court said, you really don't have any evidence here to indicate that these folks did anything improper, let alone deliberately indifferent.
So were some of those physician depositions taken?
No, Your Honor, they were not.
Okay. So now, wouldn't a lawyer have taken the deposition in order to determine that when they talked about some of the problems, how his levels continued to go up? And how that had an impact on the level of treatment?
I assume that if counsel had been present, those depositions would have been noticed and taken.
Right, and they would have been different. I mean, take that back, because none of them were taken. Yes, those depositions would have been taken, and don't you agree that during the course of those depositions, and I'm not saying you have to let your clients go under the bus, but in the course of those depositions, the lawyers would have looked in great detail at how he was treated and asked questions about why certain things were done, because my understanding is he wasn't receiving treatment for kidney disease, and he was never referred to a nephrologist as these levels continued to go up. So at what point was it reasonable medical care to have to seek out additional opinions or give further tests or do some other treatment?
I'm assuming there would have been such cross-examination.
Mm-hmm. And that might have made a real difference.
But that would make a difference in any case in which there's a pro se litigant. In other words, there's
so,
always...
Yeah, and in a case where it would have made a difference, then counsel should have been appointed. And this is the Northern District of Illinois. You're familiar with that program we have where counsel can be appointed for civil plaintiffs?
Yes, Your Honor, I am.
Yeah, so it wasn't like the court had to seek out and put out an ad or, you know, search or say in the courtroom who can take this case. He could have automatically sent this and a lawyer would have been appointed right away.
But I think that we would have cross-examined or we would have taken more depositions, argument can be made in any case, regardless of the character of the pro se plaintiff. Because very rarely in any case does a pro se plaintiff take his own depositions. So that really doesn't go, I mean, then if you adopt that strategy or you adopt that rule, then every pro se plaintiff should have an attorney.
The difficulty here is the complexity of, you've got some competing medical conditions here, diabetes and the kidney issues, and the complexity of the medical aspect of that is where it's different than every other pro se case. That's where the complication is, where the need for counsel concern really focuses in my mind.
I recognize that, and even if the court were to disagree with our position as to appointment of counsel, there clearly is no prejudice here. Counsel was appointed here on October 31st of 2012. There has been a 4 or 5 month gap between that period of time and the time of the district court's decision. There was, as I believe has already been pointed out, no motion to reopen discovery.
And there were affidavits from the treating physicians of record in your motion for summary judgment at that point?
I believe there were. And what I'm saying is, at that point, I think it's incumbent to do something. You file a motion to reopen discovery. You file a motion for the appointment of an expert under Federal Rule of Evidence 706. But you clearly see that that's the issue in the case. Unlike Santiago, there was no restriction on the appointment here. And I think if we look at footnote 14 in Santiago, that makes it crystal clear. That case is limited to the facts, and the facts are very different. In Santiago, there was a 2-year hiatus after the close of discovery. The order specified you are appointed for trial only, and the appointment, or the appearance at least, of counsel was 2 months before a trial date. No trial date here. No restriction on the ability to reopen discovery. In fact, Judge Maravich, along with the appointment, granted a motion to extend time to respond to the motion for summary judgment. In closing, I would simply say you can't have it both ways. You can't sit on your hands and do nothing or make a tactical decision, as we heard was made today, and then hold that in your pocket as an extra chit and then say, well, there's my prejudice.
So then you would say that district courts can deny counsel to deserving pro se plaintiffs during the most important stage of civil proceedings, discovery, so long as counsel is appointed at some point before the case is resolved. And then counsel then has to make that motion to reopen.
I'm not advocating that as a rule. What I'm saying is there is a second prong to Pruitt. And in this case, that prejudice prong is clearly not satisfied. We didn't have a trial date. We didn't have any, you know, drop-dead deadlines. You make a simple motion, which is made every day on the floors below us. Look, I need more discovery. I need an expert. Or, at least, if you don't make that motion, I've gone out and independently found that. Here's my expert's report that I will show you, if you allow me to. There is nothing in the record to indicate that that evidence, which would have made a difference, was even available. There's a lot of speculation, a lot of would have, could have, should have, but nothing that says we went out and got someone, we investigated this, here's the evidence that we would have presented that would have made a difference. There's nothing like that in the record. Thank you.
Let me ask you one further question. Would you acknowledge that there are some circumstances in which having your opponent obtain representation would be the fair and right thing to do as an officer of the court?
I'm not sure I understand the question, Your Honor.
I'm assuming you deal with a lot of these prisoner cases.
Yes, I do.
And a lot of them are frivolous, as we know.
Yes?
Yeah. And this is one where there seem to be more involved in this. When you look at, this isn't a situation where the inmate never asked for help, never asked to be treated by the doctors, failed to do all those kinds of things. And there was no expert witness or any discovery. So I'm just wondering, is there a point where counsel as an officer of the court should not oppose the appointment of counsel? Because that would be the right thing, that would be the just thing, that would be the fair thing to do.
I think there conceivably could be a point. I don't believe that that point was reached in this case.
Did you oppose the motions for appointment of counsel in this case?
I would have to go back and look, Your Honor. I believe the second one may have been opposed, yes. Because at that point, we believed that it was being done not totally for the reasons that were articulated. Everything we were getting, there was a lot of discovery filed. There were motions filed. There were responses to motions. They tried to default us. This man was not totally helpless. In fact, he exhibited a high level of acumen in responding to everything that we did, perhaps because he had Mr. Dolby's help. And maybe that is the defining factor in an answer to Your Honor's question. And when that fell by the wayside, when it was clear he no longer had that support, Judge Maravich recognized that. And he said, I have a motion for summary judgment that's complicated. Now it looks like he's not doing as well. His support mechanism is gone. I'm going to give him some very good lawyers, and they're going to be able to find out how to respond to this motion. So when the circumstances changed, the court changed its position. But during the period of time when we did object, he was responding, he was litigating the case on an extremely high level for a person of this acumen, as well as a pro se plaintiff in my experience.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time does Ms. Davis have?
2 minutes.
The one thing that is clear in this case is that Mr. Henderson was never prosecuting this case on his own. And for counsel to say that he was exuding a high level of acumen, it's not clear from the record how that could be. At every turn, he said he did not understand. He could not read. He could not write. He was at the mercy of another inmate. The inmate filed also an affidavit saying he has a low IQ. I can't continue to help him. And during all of that, he was never afforded counsel during all of those stages until discovery was closed. And even when he asked for discovery to be reopened, he was denied that opportunity. Yes, there may have been an opportunity to revisit that again. But at the point where the district court had continued to say that it found that he was competent, even though this particular plaintiff had shown that he was completely and totally incompetent to litigate the case on his own, there was no reason to believe there would be a different outcome just because there was a different person asking for it. The case had gone.
The different person was a lawyer.
The different person was a lawyer, but there was no difference in the deficiencies that had been shown all along, and there was no difference in the fact that Mr. Henderson had not been able to have counsel during deposition or to take any expert discovery or to hire any experts in this case, a deliberate indifference case, which was going to require some complex level of analysis in this case. This was a very complex case, and the Santiago case is really not distinguishable from this situation, wherein even though counsel was appointed at the time of trial, the court said very plainly that in situations just like that where there was not necessarily any reason to believe there would be a different outcome, that not seeking to reopen discovery at that point was not a bar to showing
well,
the prejudice.
Wasn't in that Santiago case, didn't the court say you're appointed for trial and for trial only?
He did say appointed for trial only, but it did say that the basis for, it didn't, but the basis for the court's opinion that there was not a bar to showing prejudice was not solely because he was appointed for trial only. It was because there was no reason to believe there would be any different outcome, even if he had asked. That was the two reasons why the court looked at that, not just the one. And so here we have that same situation. So we would be, I see I'm out of time, we would be asking that the court take all of it into consideration and the fairness of this case when it's rendered.
And the court never said, now that you're appointed counsel, I'm going to give you an opportunity to do any discovery.
No
discovery. All right. Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.